why what happens to China's power grid matters for your shopping habits and the global economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, October 18th. Good to have you along. Let's start the week off with big news out of China, the world's second largest economy, one which is, we learned today, growing at a much slower rate than before. This matters for the rest of the world for a lot of reasons, one of which is that China is, in many ways, the hub of the global supply chain. It's the source of many of the products that are currently stuck on ships waiting outside U.S. ports or waiting to get even close to U.S. ports. But the country is also facing its own economic troubles. Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us going.
One big problem that China's economy is facing is its power supply. China's grid still relies heavily on coal, and lately, coal has been in short supply.
There was a natural disaster. There was some flooding that flooded parts of where they were producing coal.
Damian Ma is managing director of the think tank Macro Polo at the Paulson Institute. He says the factories that need that coal are having trouble making products other countries are buying.
It's really heavy industry in China, like steel, that is really facing the brunt of the power shortages, in part because they're the biggest energy guzzlers.
Meanwhile, China is implementing strict COVID safety measures at factories and ports, says Christopher Balding, senior fellow at the Henry Jackson Society.
So whether it's one individual that works at the port or whether it is potentially one shipment in an entire port that tests positive for COVID, they will shut down the entire port for 1 to 2 weeks.
Ports can always reopen, and China has plenty of coal it can mine, says Anne Stevenson-Yang at J Capital Research. What's more troubling long-term, she says, is China's real estate sector.
You know, this massive speculative market in real estate and excess construction.
Lately, there have been signs that the real estate market could be starting to crack. Stevenson-Yang says that could have a big impact on the wealth and purchasing power of Chinese consumers.
And then you're going to have secondary effect on international companies that have big businesses in China, like GM and P&G and Unilever, this type of company.
Moody's estimates that the property sector and other related industries make up nearly a quarter of China's GDP. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Bringing it back home to the U.S. and the American housing market, you know how Zillow and some other online housing sites started buying houses recently? Instant offers and such? Well, Zillow said over the weekend that basically it bought a bit too much house, or rather too many houses, and it doesn't have enough operational capacity, aka people, to do the work of fixing up all those houses and selling them. That news was first from Bloomberg, which reports the company is hitting pause on buying houses for the rest of the year. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on what this means for Zillow's business model and the real estate market overall.
Zillow's what's called an iBuyer, and like Opendoor and Redfin, it uses algorithms to figure out what to pay for a house, then it buys it, then it sells it. Anthony Orlando teaches real estate at Cal Poly Pomona. He says those computers are good at coming up with a price for houses, but they can only do so much.
So I think what Zillow is finding is that even with the advances of technology, it's still hard to operate at that kind of scale when you have to do that many individual transactions.
Zillow says it has plenty of cash. It just doesn't have enough on-the-ground workers and vendors, folks to install that farmhouse sink or repair a roof. The company said it tried to ramp up hiring over the last few quarters. It just couldn't keep up. But Rajiv Dhawan, professor of economic forecasting at Georgia State University, says he thinks Zillow's also probably recalibrating as it looks at the real estate market's near-term future.
There is a demand and supply problem both. The iBuyers are like asking for too much. And on the buying side, this company is saying, maybe I don't want to pay you that much. I'm not going to make any money on this deal.
It's true that in a lot of the country, the real estate market has finally started to cool down. Susan Walker of the Wharton School says there are a couple of things working against Zillow right now.
Interest rates going up, which will hurt financing costs, and prices going down. That's a double whammy on the business model of iBuyers in a cyclical market.
And so she says hitting the pause button on buying more houses could be a prudent approach for iBuyers right now. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not quite a manic Monday, but a mixed Monday. With labor in such high demand and employers desperate to fill open positions, many employees are flexing their organizing muscles. Thousands of U.S. workers are currently on strike, including staff at Kellogg's and at farm equipment maker John Deere. Some nurses and healthcare workers with Kaiser Permanente in Oregon and California are threatening to walk off the job as well, and there may be more coming. A common issue in each of these situations is a dispute over a two-tier system for wages and benefits. Marketplace's Caroline Champlin has more.
Two-tier systems set workers into two categories. Current employees get to keep their existing wages and benefits. But based on the date they're hired, new employees get lower pay, fewer benefits. The two-tiered system was a tactic that some companies used in the 1980s, during recessionary times, says UC Berkeley labor economist Michael Reich.
Generally, they don't work out because over time, the newer workers get more resentful, and so most two-tier systems didn't last very long.
But some employers have seen two-tiered systems as workable recently, says Cornell ILR School Dean Alex Colvin.
Companies sometimes are still doing things that made sense last year in the sort of depths of the pandemic that don't make sense to workers today.
Because Colvin says these days labor has been hard to come by and quit rates are way up. Workers are feeling confident enough in their employment that they're willing to strike for the sake of their future colleagues. And Wharton Management Professor Peter Capelli says workers are also seeing wage gains depleted because of prices.
Inflation is rising. By some measures, it's going up faster than wages. So if you're an employee, you know, you feel like you're actually declining. In real terms, you are.
Capelli says based on the outcome of these strikes, other employers may take a second look at their use of two-tiered systems. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
According to the U.S. Census Bureau, Asian Americans are the fastest growing racial or ethnic group in the United States. That includes people who identify as having roots in China, Japan, India, Malaysia, Pakistan, Thailand, Cambodia, the Philippines, just to name a few. In a new book called The Loneliest Americans, writer J. Caspian Kang explores what it really means to be, quote, Asian American, and explains that many people included in that designation, like his family, trace their U.S. origins to the 1965 Immigration Act, which lifted restrictions on immigration from certain Asian countries, but preferenced educated workers and their families.
Both my parents are North Korean refugees, escaped to the South. They grew up in a war zone. And once they got to the United States, I think they bought into the idea of like American dream and opportunity, and they did quite well themselves. And I think that that type of narrative, which is very common, but not certainly monolithic, but, you know, like is the one that we hear the most about Asian Americans. But you also have, you know, starting in the 1980s, 1990s, you actually also have a large population of people who are refugees. You have a large population of Asians mm-hmm. who come over who are not wealthy. And their stories have been more or less ignored, and that they're not sort of counted as being Asian American, and sort of brings to question, like, well, you know, like, what does this identity mean, right? Like,
Asian Americans have the biggest wealth gap between the highest earners and the lowest earners of any racial group, and this really ties back into what you're saying about these different identities. And I wonder, at least when we're looking at economic statistics, when we're talking about the economy and how people live in the United States, what it means to have these separate groups under one umbrella.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that we should just disaggregate all of these groups, right? Mm-hmm. There's no real harm being done when you just say, okay, well, Hmong refugees, for example, right, and who live in Minneapolis or in Northern California have completely different set of circumstances than people who come from Korea or people who come from India, for example. And I do think that thinking about things in terms of class is a lot more convincing, at least to me, because I don't really think that a racial identity amongst Asian Americans exists in the same way that it exists amongst Black Americans, for example, where there is a sort of shared sense of struggle. Like, none of those things are present in Asian America.
I mean, if we're talking about catch-all terms, Asian Americans also get grouped under the people of color umbrella. And one of the reasons that that exists is because businesses and groups and organizations often use these labels to try to improve their diversity or equity efforts. What should they be doing instead?
You know, I think that the term has a very sympathetic history, right? Like, it starts with ways for generally women of color to organize themselves politically. But that's not really what we talk about anymore when we talk about people of color. Like, it's mostly like a corporate term, right? It's a term that gets bandied around in diversity training. Like, what does it mean? Like, do we really think that the people who are recent immigrants to the United States think of themselves as people of color? I don't think that they do. The more we sort of preference that type of talk, right, where there's this assumed solidarity, I think that does limit conversations basically to the concerns of a upper middle class or upwardly mobile middle class type of person.
Speaking of solidarity, you talk a great deal in this book about small business ownership and the role that this plays in the Asian American, air quotes, Asian American community, and how small business ownership not only shapes the relationships within certain Asian American communities, but also how it shapes relationships between Asian Americans and other groups, often the Black community. Can you lay out a couple of examples of how that shows up?
Right. The biggest example, and the one that most people will know, is Korean store owners in Los Angeles, right? And the sort of, and what happened during the Los Angeles riots, where a great number of those businesses were burned to the ground. And some of the precipitating events, which include the shooting of Latasha Harlins, which is a 14-year-old Black girl, by a Korean shop owner, which, you know, happened about a year before. Generally, the argument that's been made is that there are two types of immigrants who come to the United States in terms of their relationship with both white people and with Black people. The first are people who come in and have a direct competition in the labor market. So that includes, like, the Irish, for example, right? The Irish come over to the United States. They're not really considered white. And then they're in direct labor competition with Black people. And that, you know, through that interaction, they start to differentiate themselves. Like, that's the process of how they become white. For a lot of Asian Americans, that doesn't really happen. Their interactions with the Black community mostly come from opening up shops, right? And that isn't necessarily like direct competition in labor. You're sort of seen as a leech by a lot of people, but you're also not seen as a threat by the people who actually have power. And so that allows you a certain type of social mobility that other groups might not have.
Asian Americans are not the only group that doesn't fit neatly into this Black, white, racial binary that shapes so much of American culture, or at least the sort of predominant narrative of American culture. I mean, what did going through the process of writing this book, of your own exploration, teach you about where Indigenous people or Middle Eastern people or Latinx people or anybody else fits when we're navigating these discussions, which have probably evolved a lot more quickly over the last year or so?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is space for a type of totalizing or large umbrella for all those people. The way in which we can access that is through trying to reconfigure our concerns about these things away from questions of identity and to try and root it in thinking about these issues through a lens of class, which, you know, has become unfashionable recently, because so many of these conversations are sort of dominated by people who would say, like, as an Asian American X, Y, and Z, and presume to speak for everybody in that group. I think that we can reconfigure that, or we can sort of readjust that to create opportunities for people to have solidarity with one another.
Jay Caspian King's new book is The Loneliest Americans. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up...
The work-life balance is a lot better.
It's not impossible, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 36 points, a tenth of a percent, to finish at 35,258. The Nasdaq picked up 124 points, 8-tenths percent, to end at 15,021. And the S&P 500 added 15 points, 3-tenths percent, to land at 4486. After that Zillow announcement Andy told us about, shares in Zillow fell almost 9 4/10 percent. In retail, Amazon says it plans to add 150,000 workers for the holiday season, so shares were up 1 1/10 percent. Walmart, which also wants to hire 150,000 folks for the season, added 8-tenths percent. Bonds fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.59%, and you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. There's a big UN climate summit coming up in Glasgow, Scotland at the end of the month. Delegates from all over the world are set to attend. And ahead of the two-week meeting, the BBC's climate editor, Justin Rowlett, is having a look at some of the efforts in the United Kingdom to green their economy. For example, wind energy. He recently visited the world's largest offshore wind farm and sent this report.
I'm in a speedboat with a team trying to get out to service a wind turbine. The waves are up to 10 feet high. There's no way we'll get safely onto the ladder on the turbine in this, so it's back to the bright red mothership for us. This service vessel is where the team of engineers who keep the blades turning live and work. They do 12-hour shifts for 14 straight days and then get 2 weeks off. It can be tough, but the wind industry is creating thousands of well-paid, skilled jobs, most of them in places here along the east coast of northern England that have seen their traditional industries decline. Dan O'Toole is the operations manager for Hornsea One for Ørsted, the company that owns the wind farm.
My granddad went to sea when he was 14 as a cabin boy. For seafaring families like mine, offshore wind has really given more options. 80% of our workforce in the East Coast come from within an hour of our operational hub. So it's really opened up a world of opportunities that really didn't exist, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Everyone gets their own cabin. There's a big lounge for watching movies and playing video games. And the food is great.
Jill, what's for tea?
Today is fish, chips and mushy peas. And we've got bread and butter pudding and custard.
A day later, and the sea is calmer. This time, we do get to the ladder. It's quite a climb, and this is just to the balcony at the bottom. But there is bad news.
So we've managed to get onto the turbine, but get this. The crane isn't working, which means we can't get our gear up off the boat, which means we can't go up the turbine.
But from down at the bottom, you really do get a sense of how very, very, very big these monsters are. Each one is around 650 feet tall, and Ørsted says each turn of the blades generates enough electricity to power an average UK home for a day. Josh Gallagher is one of the engineers.
It's nice to know that your time and your energy is contributing to this world that runs on green energy, and it's something what's going to be a better future for everybody. We're really lucky to have it on our doorstep. I don't take that for granted at all.
We got up as far as the platform there, but we couldn't go any further because of the broken crane. What does that tell you about the challenges you face in your daily work?
Just that you've got to remain open and ready for whatever could arise. I think being adaptable just in general is a good thing because life's always full of surprises.
As we head back to the mainland, we can see the entire wind farm stretching into the distance. And Ørsted has almost finished another, even bigger wind farm next door. What's more, the wind revolution isn't just happening here in the UK. Offshore wind is taking off all around the world. Reporting from the North Sea, I'm the BBC's Justin Rowlett for Marketplace.
talk a lot about different jobs on this show and what a worker's day-to-day looks like. But maybe what we don't talk about enough is mental health and what people in high-stress positions might be going through. For example, social workers. So today, we bring you the latest installment of our series, My Economy, from Baltimore.
My name is Jasmine. Jasmine Bolden. I go by Kimmy, though. I live in Baltimore, Maryland. And I am a macro social worker. So a macro social worker is someone who works on a community and national level. So this is where policies are implemented. Social workers can work in that background to help, you know, with things like grants and stimulus payments for lower income families. When I worked on a micro level, and that's just direct care, I was overwhelmed a lot. I think when you're helping people, sometimes we forget that we have our own issues to go through. You know, our mental health is important as well. So I felt myself having a lot of burnout and being stressed. But now that I've switched to a macro level, the work-life balance is a lot better. I did just start, so I'm not completely, you know, in the field yet, but I have a lot more flexibility. You know, we get our license and then we get into the field and jobs only want to pay $45,000 a year, which we know that $45,000 a year is not enough to get you through life. One way I would say that social workers are overworked is the amount of clients. Sometimes you can get 45 clients, and 45 clients and getting paid $100 a session, it doesn't equate to the amount of time that you're putting in. With clients, you are dealing with 45 different personality, and 45 is just the general number. Depending on where you work, it could be 50, it could be 70. Each client is different. Each client has a different mental health issue, and you have to plan accordingly. And it takes a lot of your time. It takes away from the time that you can spend with your family, your personal self-care. And I just feel like as social workers, because we deal with, you know, this high demand of people with mental health, that we should be paid more for it. I like helping people, but I also feel like with helping people, there are different platforms that you can do that on. So I don't think I want to be a social worker for my entire life. I definitely want to be a content creator on my own business. Mainly because I want to have something to leave behind for my children.
That was Jasmine Bolden in Baltimore, Maryland. The series only works with your help, so tell us how your economy is doing at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out, here in Washington, D.C., we have an in-our-face reminder that infrastructure is crucial. Following an investigation into a train derailment last week, the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority pulled about 60% of its rail cars out of service last night, just ahead of Monday rush hour, which means only 40 trains are serving D.C. area riders today, with packed cars and long waits between trains. Ridership on the D.C. Metro, which also serves parts of Maryland and Virginia, was about 626,000 people a day pre-pandemic. It dropped down to 177,000 people a day last year and was slowly climbing back up. Needless to say, a lot of those riders aren't exactly happy to be back on the train today. All right, we gotta go, but first, your moment of economic context. CNBC did a little digging into some data that came out from the Federal Reserve recently about just who owns stocks in this country. Maybe not a surprise, but the wealthiest 10% of Americans now own a record 89% of all U.S. stocks. So basically all of them. And those folks saw the value of their stocks jump 43% from before the pandemic to June of this year. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.